And welcome to the Behind the Panels one-shot. In this first one-shot, we're interviewing Jeff Lemire, author of the brand new Green Arrow run for DC Comics. I'm Richard Gray.
And I'm Dave McVeigh.
Jeff Lemire is a lovely man who lives in Canada. He's not only is he authoring the latest Green Arrow run, you'll know his name from things like Animal Man, Justice League Dark, DC Vertigo's Sweet Tooth, and his graphic novels such as Essex County and Underwater Welder. Jeff speaks about a whole lot of stuff in this thing, from including his Green Arrow run right through to his solo work and his own views on the comic book industry. We hope you enjoy. I'll start off with talking about Green Arrow, if that's cool.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because we've got, of course, Green Arrow 17 is out in stores this week. Yep. But I understand you've been kind of living with that character since the middle of last year. So was Green Arrow really on your radar ever before that?
No, not at all. I mean, I grew up reading DC stuff. You know, I was always a DC Comics fan over Marvel stuff as a kid for whatever reason. You were either into the... Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the mid-80s, so you were either into the X-Men or the Teen Titans, and for whatever reason, I went for the Teen Titans, so I was always a DC guy, and then, but, you know, Green Arrow was never really a character other than just seeing him in Justice League and stuff. He wasn't someone that I ever really cared for as a kid or whatever, and I think maybe that was just because, you know, back then he didn't really even have his own monthly book or anything, so he wasn't really, you know, long story short, no, he wasn't really on my radar.
I will throw out there that aside from Richard, I think it's probably the same for everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I got the book, you know, I was looking for another DC project and something that was a little bit closer to the, you know, the center of the DC universe, the Animal Man and Swamp Thing and Justice League Dark and all the stuff I'd been doing, which I love and still love doing. They're all really horror books, and they're kind of off in their own little corner. And I thought it would be fun to do something a little more close to the center of the DC universe, but still, you know, something that I could kind of have my own take on it and kind of bring my own voice to it. And when Dan Didio suggested Green Arrow to me, it just seemed like the potential was there to do a really cool sort of, almost noir crime kind of superhero epic. And when I thought about it that way, I got really interested in the character. And I also really like the character of Oliver Queen now, just in terms of kind of this redemption story of this guy who, you know, he was born into privilege and he had everything he could ever want handed to him, yet he could never really live up to this legacy that his father had. So in my story, basically, we just tear everything down and he loses everything right away and he kind of has to rebuild himself. And so I kind of like redemption stories like that. And so there was definitely a lot there for me to play with.
You sort of touched on there the fact that Green Arrow is now at the center of the DC universe in a lot of ways. And of course, there's a TV series that's a big flagship CW as well. Has there been any pressure on you at all to conform Arrow to a certain mold to meet?
No, not at all. Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I got the gig in July of last year, and the show, you know, was in production, but I certainly hadn't seen it yet. So I really had to develop my own sort of take and story and everything months before the series premiered. So they were really developed, you know, separately. And even now, there's no pressure for me to try to make the character more like the TV show version or make the storylines sort of in line with what they're doing. They really are separate things, which is good. You know, I'm glad that I have that freedom. But at the same time, it's really nice that there's so much more awareness around the character at the moment. And the TV show is doing so well in the States. And so, you know, it's just more people potentially that could tune into the comic. And that's a good thing for me.
With that in mind, what are your impressions of the TV series? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. You know, it's TV, so there are limitations, and they have to sort of follow a certain format every week and stuff like that, you know, with network television. But I think considering that, they've done a pretty good job of creating, like, a really grounded take on a vigilante superhero. And I think that, you know, people who are enjoying the TV show but maybe haven't read the comic or don't read comics in general will find the transition to our comic somewhat easy, just in terms of I approached it in a really grounded way as well. You know, it's a superhero comic, but he's not you know, he's not fighting really outlandish supervillains every week and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. It is really a street level kind of crime noir story and very much grounded in reality. So I think there is, just aesthetically, there's a crossover there that people can hopefully, you know, help bridge that gap.
You were just on the topic of that grounding of the character. I know you've mentioned Mike Grell and Bendis and Miller's respective takes on Daredevil. Does this mean that your run will see a sort of a return to the urban hunter, Ollie?
That's the only version I had any interest in doing. You know, so that was sort of right away what I pitched, like definitely a return to the Mike Grell era of this really, you know, this hero of the gutters, this hero of the street, urban hunter, you know, basically kind of character. So that's really what I was after. And, you know, the Mike Grell stuff really holds up quite well, actually, when you read the whole run that he did. Some really amazing character work in there. And that's really what inspired me was that. And also Denny O'Neill's Question comics from the 80s.
Yeah.
I really love those. And then more recently, stuff like Bendis's run on Daredevil and, you know, some of the more recent Batman stuff. And just these really kind of street-level superhero stories that were successful, and it's the kind of thing I'm trying to tap into without ripping those guys off, you know?
It's music to my ears, because Grell's run is probably one of my favorite runs.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And sort of on that note, I guess, are you planning to be in for the long haul on this title and maybe challenge?
Yeah, I sure hope so, you know? I mean, you never know what's going to happen, and it's not all in my control, but as long as the book's successful and they let me keep going, I really want to try to do a sustained run on this book for as long as I can, and we'll see.
And coming to this book as both a writer and an artist, coming to somebody else's creation in a lot of ways, is it easy to start working with a different artist, in this case, Andrea Sorrentino, not knowing up front whether or not they're going to get your vision of the character?
When I do stuff that I draw myself, and especially stuff that's creator owned, you know, I get to control every aspect of the storytelling and everything, and that's really rewarding, you know, obviously. But the fun part for me of doing the DC stuff, aside from just working with these characters who I love, is the collaborative aspect, you know. So I know that when, for instance, when I start Green Arrow, it's not my Green Arrow, you know, it's our Green Arrow. It's the byproduct of both of our visions kind of coming together. And the same thing with when I did Animal Man with Travel Foreman and that now with Steve Pugh. And, so for me, it's really easy when I do the DC stuff to kind of let go of the visual side of it and just completely leave that up to the artist. And you know, I worry about plot and character and dialogue and things like that, and I let them sort of inform all the visual stuff. But you know, having said that, I did have a pretty specific vision for the kind of book I wanted Green Arrow to be, you know, and so we chose an artist specifically that we thought would be in line with that. And Andrea, he's if you've seen his work on American Vampire, he does very stark, you know, black and white kind of noirish work to begin with, so I thought he would be a really cool sort of look for a superhero comic, you know, the weird tension of having a superhero drawn in that style, I thought would be interesting and really fit that vision. So, so it's kind of a mix of both things letting him sort of bring his voice to it, but also, you know, trying to choose the right artist that kind of, you know, fits your vision of the book. So.
It'd almost be a shame to see it in color, having looked at some of the sketches of.
It's weird. The only good thing is that he actually colored the first issue itself, so is his vision. And we did some cool stuff in it visually. You know, I had this idea where certain panels, key moments in action, in the layouts would be actually stay in black and white with just green as a spot color, and we did that throughout the first arc, and it really worked well. So it's kind of a mix of color and black and white and some really kind of some strange visual techniques that he tried himself, and it's pretty cool. It's actually pretty experimental for a monthly superhero comic, which is really cool.
That's very cool. I look forward to seeing it later this week.
Yeah.
with the rest of your DC's New 52, you've obviously still very busy with Animal Man, Justice League Dark. The three monthlies you've now got going, did that contribute at all to the end of Sweet Tooth, or was that reaching its natural conclusion?
Oh, no, not at all. No. Sweet Tooth was always, you know, that was a book where I always, when I developed the idea, I knew what the ending of that story was, and it was just a natural conclusion. And you know, I was doing three monthlies while I was working on Sweet Tooth, and it wasn't a problem.
And now I'm actually working on a new Vertigo book as well that I'm drawing called Trillium, which will launch later this year. So the Vertigo stuff that I write and draw doesn't really have any effect on my, you know, my monthly schedule seems to be one book that I'm writing and drawing and then two or three monthly. So no, it certainly didn't have any effect on ending Sweet Tooth the way it did. That was always on my own terms.
So I guess we have to ask the same question that we would ask somebody like Brian Michael Bendis, which is, have they cloned you? How do you fit this much in?
I don't know. I'm a really good multitasker. And, I don't know. I just have a, I guess I have a really good work ethic and I'm very disciplined and stuff, but it's, you know, when you love what you do, when your job is also your passion, it's really easy to want to do it all the time. And, so for me, I'm just always wanting to work, you know, so it's not hard for me to balance a lot of projects and get really excited about them.
I guess we're all the better for that work ethic, really.
Thanks.
And just on that topic, I mean, obviously, in addition to those three monthly titles, you've also managed to release Underwater Welder in the last 6 months as well. And when you hit upon an idea for a standalone comic, a creator-owned comic, what determines the format that you ultimately presented in? I mean, in this case, it was a graphic novel as opposed to, say, an ongoing series like Sweet Tooth.
Yeah, I mean, generally, the stuff that I do on my own is graphic novel format, you know, and Sweet Tooth was kind of an anomaly just in that, you know, I never imagined that I would do a monthly comic. It just didn't seem like something that was possible, really, you know, and I always just did graphic novels, but when the opportunity to pitch for a monthly book came up, I pitched Sweet Tooth, so that was almost a special circumstance, you know. Really, I do prefer the more standalone, close-ended stories where I can tell a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, right in one big chunk rather than the ongoing thing where you're kind of uncertain of when it will end and how it will end. So, so I don't know if I'll do another monthly, ongoing monthly again for a while, you know. I think even Trillium, my next Vertigo monthly, will be a limited thing, 10-issue thing. So.
Right. And what do you read in terms of your influences, comics or otherwise?
Comics right now, the stuff that I'm into, you know, I follow writers and stuff, so I'm really into Jason Aaron stuff. I'm liking, I love Scalped, obviously, but that's which ended, but I'm really enjoying his Thor and his X-Men, and I follow Hickman as well, and Scott Snyder stuff, obviously, you know,
definitely,
but more and more I find myself reading a lot more prose lately, just because, you know, I spend so much time thinking about comics all day that I almost need a break at night when I need to read something else. So I've been reading a lot more prose and kind of, which is good. It's kind of been informing my work in a different way. So.
Well, I was about to say, I think Snyder is the flavor of the month at the moment with his entire Death of the Family thing. I think it's on everybody's lips at the moment. Just out of curiosity, I know you can't say anything, but we want to have it on record saying you can't say anything. What's on the tray, do you think?
Oh, I know. I've known for months.
So
I get to read Scott's scripts months and months before they come out. So I've already read a bunch of the Superman stuff too. It's great to we share everything. So
all right.
But yeah, it is Batman's head on the tray.
Okay, cool. End of series.
You guys.
Yeah. That was a major exclusive for us right there. Also, just on the sort of topic of graphic novels, I mean, you've sort of mentioned that you couldn't have really told Underwater World in any other format, I guess. But some of your previous novels have received pretty major acclaim around the world, and particularly Essex County, which was, I believe, shortlisted for one of the essential Canadian novels of the decade.
Yeah, that was really great.
which is, you know, so to me demonstrates a sort of a changing attitude for graphic novels in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you feel as though there's a different attitude between, say, Canada and the US about that? Or any?
No, I don't think so. I think Canada's it's a bigger country, but obviously a smaller population. So when you know, any author or filmmaker or whatever who is successful gets a bit more attention within the country just because there's so few of us, you know. So when my books, which were firmly rooted in Canada, you know, the narrative was set in Canada and it was about a small Canadian town, and yet they were so successful in the U.S., I think it got a lot of attention in Canada because of that, you know. But in general, I do think, obviously, the attitude and the acceptance towards the medium is changing all the time. You know, mm-hmm. even 5 years ago, I don't think you would ever have seen a book like Essex County shortlisted for an award like that, you know? So, it's great. And I think there's just so much good stuff being put out. That's the thing. It's like, you know, 25, 30 years ago when Mouse and Watchmen and The Dark Knight kind of reached that public awareness of, and sort of introduced the public to the idea of the graphic novel. I think the reason it didn't catch on as much back then is because after people read those two or three sort of major works, there wasn't as much stuff for them to find, you know? Whereas now, if you read Essex County, then you can go to the bookstore and find dozens of amazing graphic novels, you know, and you can kind of, there's just such a broad range of stuff, and so many different genres, and there's something for everybody, really, and I think it's just going to get better and better.
And on that topic, I guess, what advice would you give for people who are trying to break into that industry these days?
Well, I can only talk about what I did, and for me, I just knew that... you know, ironically, I knew my drawing style and the stuff I wanted to write about really didn't fit with DC or Marvel, you know, and so I didn't try to get into DC or Marvel, or I didn't try to write superhero comics or anything. I just did my own thing and self-published at first and just kind of told the stories I wanted to tell and didn't really worry about what was popular or what publishers might be interested in. And then, you know, the ironic part is as a result of that, I end up working for DC because I guess I kind of had my own voice and developed my own sort of style. And you know, and inevitably they look for people like that who can kind of bring new energy to these characters that have been around for 50 or 60 years. So I guess just follow your own voice and not worry about, what you think editors are looking for or what's popular at the moment. You know, if the story you really want to tell doesn't seem like something that's really commercial or whatever, that shouldn't influence you. You know, you have to just do what you're passionate about. And hopefully, you know, if you're digging what you're doing, chances are someone else will too. So.
Interesting. In your, the introduction to Underwater Welder, Damon Lindelof actually talks about the fact that, the book is the greatest Twilight Zone never produced. And, it made me actually wonder whether or not you've ever thought about moving your material to an animated form or a film form.
I really, honestly, I love comics so much, and I don't really have a lot of interest in working in other mediums, you know? I feel like comics can do so much more than film or television can do, and it's such a much, for me, creatively, it's so much more direct, you know? I can sit down, and whatever I put on the paper is what people see, whereas if you're working in a film, you have to filter your ideas through so many different people, and it's so expensive, and it's really hard to maintain a vision like that, you know, one person's voice, and... you know, I don't, for me, film and TV aren't nearly as rewarding creatively as doing comics, but, so I'm really have no interest in pursuing it personally, but, having said that, you know, if someone else were interested in adapting my stuff, and that's totally a different situation, as long as I wasn't involved and whatever, that's always interesting to see someone else interpret your ideas and stuff.
Well, I could definitely see Underwater Welder as an animated film. It is it's a sensational piece, and
oh, thanks.
The art style is just remarkable. I'd love to see that in a I don't know if you know the Scott Free logo, but that kind of style of animation
that's
would
cool.
be fantastic. Richard?
Look, the only other thing I really wanted to ask is, look, you did some pretty major events last year with your Animal Man and some of the Swamp Thing crossovers. Can we expect anything big in the short term for Arrow or any of your other titles?
We have some stuff planned with Justice League Dark and Justice League of America and Justice League. Jeff Johns and I are working on a big crossover for the summer, so that's something that's coming.
Cool.
Excellent. Really look forward to it. Jeff, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it was my pleasure, guys. Thanks.
What an extraordinarily nice man he is.
Oh, he was lovely. Really loved talking to him. This is, of course, one of our specials. We actually take books every week and look out for on behindthepanels.net and on iTunes as well. Look out for the regular Behind the Panels show if you've just stumbled across this individual episode, because we'll also be looking at his Underwater Welder as a standalone show.
Absolutely. And this is a man who has a truly unique vision. So,
oh, yes.
So well worth catching up with all of his work, but Underwater Welder in particular, that is our next book. So find our show, subscribe today.
And we hope to bring you more of these in the future. If there's any particular people you'd like to hear us speak to, be sure to hit us up at our regular places on behindthepanels.net, where you can send an email to us at feedback@behindthepanels.net or on facebook.com/behindthepanels.
See you soon.